and uncalled for. Vic walks me to Internal Affairs and Agent Dern's office, which isn't at all surprising, and then follows me inside, which kind of is. He just shrugs when I give him a sideways glance. Now, what kind of friend would I be if I left you to face the Dragon Mother alone? Agent Dern looks up from her computer with a wry smile. I thought it was generally agreed not to use that name to my face. Agent Ramirez, please have a seat. The Dragon Mother of Internal Affairs, Agent Samantha Dern, has been in the Bureau for almost 50 years. Her face is creased and lined, and her light makeup makes no effort to hide it, just as the silver-white hair, cropped in a flattering kind of fluffy bob, has no dye to mask it. A pair of plastic-framed reading glasses, the frames almost the same rose color of her silk blouse, perch on her nose, connected to a thin chain draped around her neck. She looks soft and kindly, like someone's favorite grandmother, but she's been known to make grown men cry in under 10 minutes. Agent Ramirez, where would you like to begin? With Amelia Anders or with Agent Ryan's call to HR?
What? Already?
I blurt, and clap a hand over my mouth. Hopefully the makeup covers just how badly my face is burning at the moment. Agent Dern pulls off her reading glasses, slowly spinning one of the earpieces between her fingers. Well, she says eventually, her face caught somewhere between sympathy and amusement. At least that's not how you found out things were over, I suppose.
Sorry, I was just
surprised, I guess. It took me 4 months to convince her we really had to tell HR we were dating, and even after we did, she was jumpy about letting colleagues find out about us. Understanding that in this instance, you have every right to tell me to butt the hell out. Are you doing all right? I am, actually. I smile at her, feeling the week's exhaustion tugging at the muscles. It sucks, but I can't say I didn't see it coming. Secret admirers can be difficult to deal with, and they're rarely as charming as movies make them out to be. Amelia is the first kid the killer has injured. Now that she's done it, though, I worry about whether or not she'll think it's easier to subdue the kids with violence first. Agent Simpkins will want to hear that concern. We've got some different details to go over at the moment. Have you worked with Drew Simpkins before?
Yes, ma'am. Edison and I were assigned to her on the child-swapping ring case 10 months ago.
That's right. That's when this idiot was in the hospital.
I was doing my job, Sam, Vic says mildly.
Agent Dern simply shrugs. You stepped in front of a bullet meant for someone who raped and murdered 8 children.
And whether or not he merits execution is for the court to decide, not the grieving father of a victim. We don't get to uphold just the laws we like. It has the sound of a conversation that's happened many times, the details changing and the tone remaining the same. Agent Dern waves off the distinction with a careless hand.
Back to the first point. Agent Ryan, you don't work in the same department, so there won't be any need to shuffle things around. But we would ask that you be discreet when people ask what happened.
I'm not interested in dragging her through the mud, ma'am, I say respectfully. Things didn't work out. That's sad, but it's not anything like a reason to sully her name through the Bureau.
I appreciate that, and I'd expect no less from one of Vic's protégés, but HR asked me to mention it. Now, for the part you're not going to like.
Vic shifts uneasily in his chair.
We have to take you off active duty.
says Agent Dern, straightforward in a way I'll probably be grateful for later.
Sam!
It's not my call, Vic. Not really. She regards me frankly, not making apologies or excuses. You know how lawyers can be. Any of the cases currently in the works, any case you touch while this is happening, could blow up at court. It's stupid, I know. If anything, you're being targeted by the killer because you excel at your job, not for any nefarious purpose. But the Bureau can't afford any perception that a clever lawyer could exploit to imply complicity. So I shake my head, trying to process this. So I'm suspended? No. But it does mean you need to be hands-off on cases. Your team has been on desk rotation anyway, and I suspect Agents Edison and Sterling will revolt if anyone tries to send them off without you. So you'll all be kept to Quantico until this is resolved. They'll be able to work on consults.
But I can't even do that.
No. You're going to have two distinct assignments, Agent Ramirez. She points to a corner of her desk nearest me, where three enormous binders stuffed with paper rest. First assignment. Your section chief feels, and I agree, that there needs to be training in place for new agents when they're assigned to crimes against children. Something specific to your division, intended to help agents adjust to one of the most difficult sections in the Bureau. Suggestions for content have been solicited from section and unit chiefs, Bureau psychologists, and agents. You might remember the questionnaire that went out a few months ago. I remember Sterling walking up behind Edison and startling him so badly he spilled his coffee over all our questionnaires. I don't remember them being replaced and turned in. We want you to write it.
Me.
You've been in the CAC division for 10 years, she reminds me. And then there's this. She holds up a much smaller binder with Sharpie calligraphy across the front. A NAT's Guide to Life. Oh, Mother of God! I can feel the blush burning down my neck and ears. Vic laughs and reaches out to nudge my shoulder.
What? Didn't know it was still floating around?
Why would anyone have that after 10 years? Because they reproduce it and pass it around to all the new agent trainees in their first week, Agent Dern informs me dryly. It's informative, personable, and humorous, and it helps settle the NATs wonderfully. Realistically, Agent Ramirez, there is very little that the Bureau will ever be able to do to prevent the burnout that happens so quickly in CAC. What we can do, however, is increase our efforts to make sure those who start working there are better prepared for what they'll face. And if that means, after reading such a guide, that they don't feel themselves suited for the division, we can transfer them out early. I wrote that very drunk, I inform her bluntly. A good third of us spent the weekends before graduation getting roaring drunk together, and that was the result. The entire thing was born out of truly terrible tequila. Written drunk, but edited sober, she points out, and 10 years of trainee agents have been using it as their Bible. This isn't just a throwaway assignment. We've had you in mind from the beginning. We weren't planning on asking you until later in the year, but there's no reason not to go ahead and ask it now. You said there were two assignments? Go back through all the cases you've worked where you've had direct contact with the children. Not the consults, not cases where you were primarily at the precinct or working with adults. Look through your notes anything you wrote about the children, not just the victims, any child. Somewhere in there may be the key to finding this murderer. This is personal for her. You are personal. If we're very lucky, somewhere in the past 10 years, one of your kids is going to ring a bell. Don't look at the case details. Don't look at the things that seem similar at a stretch. Look at the children, Agent Ramirez. That's your second assignment. That's actually already in progress, ma'am. Vic gives me a startled look that quickly shifts to a proud smile. I am 32 years old, but damned if I don't get all warm and fuzzy every time he shows he's proud of me. Agent Alcest is getting the files together on a drive, so I can see everyone's notes, not just mine. I should receive them soon.
You braved Alcest?
He asks, the smile turning impish. I've always wondered why no one refers to her as the Dragon Mother of the Archives, Agent Dern agrees.
Because dragons sometimes interact enough for a game of riddles, and she is the least motherly human I've ever met. But I'm not about to say that out loud.
Instead, I look at the beginnings of my other assignment, all the notes and suggestions from agents and leadership on what should be included in a survival guide. Training manual. The binders on the corner of the desk are a mess. Tabs and post-it notes stick out in haphazard places, and there are pages that are just shoved in, either because there wasn't any more room in the rings, or because people were just being lazy. Even odds, really. It's a hell of a lot of work, and I don't know that it'll do even half of what the bosses are hoping. No matter how prepared you are intellectually, working in CAC is an anvil chorus. The hammers always hit hard.
Edison is going to chafe at being chained to his desk for even longer, I observe eventually.
Probably, agrees Vic. But even if we gave him the option of fieldwork, he isn't going to leave you behind. Sterling is a blue-eyed ball of mischief. If there aren't enough consults and she gets bored...
Personally, I'm hoping she'll provoke Agent Edison into finally trying to bell her,
Agent Dern replies placidly. It should be quite entertaining to watch.
You know, I say before I can think better of it, for someone called the Dragon Mother, there's been remarkably little flaming.
She smiles deeply, soft lines creasing around her eyes and mouth.
I joined the Bureau at a time when females were largely considered second-class agents, she explains. Then, of course, I was put into internal affairs, which meant I was supposed to be the nagging, critical, never-lets-you-have-any-fun wife. I was the enemy. It was necessary to become a bit of a dragon, simply to ensure that no one looked at me and assumed they could get away with something. It became something of a habit, even after the reputation meant I didn't have to roar as much. Good agents, Ramirez, never have to fear internal affairs. We're here to maintain accountability with a degree of transparency, yes, but we're also here to support our agents. You're not here because you've done something wrong. I don't need to bite or roar or flame or any such thing. It makes sense now that she and Vic are old friends. I don't think they came through the academy together. She's probably got a decade on him at least. But they likely came through some of the same people. It's the way they believe in people. The way they work toward not just what the Bureau is, but what it should be, and insist on holding others to a higher standard, not to see us fail, but to see us improve and achieve.
Do you accept the assignments, Agent Ramirez? She asks gently. Aware of Vic's eyes on me, I nod.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Excellent. I'll have someone deliver the binders to your desk, along with an official memo about what's desired. Vic, you'll take her on to Simpkins.
Of course.
He stands and offers me a hand up, and it's a little silly to make someone else trek all the way over when I can just carry the binders myself. But he slaps my hand away.
Along with a memo, Mercedes. It's not in there yet. A memo can be emailed.
Stop that, he chides, and it takes a second to figure out if I said that bit out loud or if 10 years have taught him to read my face entirely too well. From Agent Dern's cocked eyebrow, I'm going to guess the latter. I murmur a goodbye to Agent Dern, get a highly amused farewell in turn, and follow Vic out the door.
Doing okay?
He asks quietly. I get it, I sigh. I don't like it, but I get it, even if I think the handbook is a bad idea. He drapes an arm around my shoulders and pulls me into a sideways hug, then keeps it there as we walk.
It draws a few looks from people as we pass. He ignores them.
A lot has landed on your doorstep, literally, and there's no one way to feel about it. This woman has invaded your home. I know you, Mercedes. I know what that means to you. I was assigned to Vic and Edison straight out of the academy, but Vic has known me a lot longer. Sometimes, inexplicably, I forget that. And then, like now, I remember. How do I sleep there? Knowing another child might be walking up the steps, I whisper. How do I stay anywhere else, knowing another child might have to sit there in blood and fear and wait?
I don't have an answer for you.
I'd call bullshit if you did. He smiles and squeezes my shoulder, using the motion to give me a small shove into the open elevator.
You're going to get through this, Mercedes, and we're going to be right beside you to make sure of that.
What happens? Giving me a curious look, he waits for the doors to close, for that sinking feeling that says, the car's in motion, then hits the emergency stop.
What happens when?
I pace the small space from wall to wall, gathering the worries into words I hope make sense. What happens when she checks on the kids?
What do you mean?
We're operating under the theory that she's going after these parents because they're hurting the kids. She brings the kids to me to keep them safe.
Right?
So what happens when she checks on Sarah, Ashley, and Sammy and finds out they're having trouble finding a home that will take all three of them? Ronnie's doing fairly well at his grandmother's, but Amelia's only family seems to be either in prison or living out of the country. What kind of home is she going to get put in? My first few foster homes, not all of them were terrible, but some of them were. What happens to Amelia if she's put in a bad home? And at what point does this killer decide that she isn't going to bring me kids to protect just for me to put them back into a flawed system?
You think she could come after you?
I think we have to acknowledge it as a possibility. We're not going to understand her framework or compulsions until we find her.
Not really.
So what happens when she gets more pissed at the system than at the parents?
She hasn't given any indication of that, he says after a moment. If it was the system as a whole she was worried about, wouldn't we see foster parents in the mix?
We might yet. There's only been three. Realistically, she's just getting started.
But she didn't start with them. What do you think the difference is?
He's not asking Agent Ramirez. He's asking Mercedes.
Fosters are strangers. You never know what you're going to get.
Your parents are the two people in the whole world who aren't supposed to hurt you. The wounds are deeper, in a way. He thinks his way through that, his weathered face mobile with the emotions that latch onto shreds of ideas or theories. Eventually, he leans against the side wall and opens his arms, and I accept the hug gratefully, conscious of the still tender scar over his heart. "I don't know how to rescue you from this," he admits softly. I shake my head. "We do our jobs. We trust Holmes and Simpkins to do theirs. I'm not sure there is a rescue." We stand like that until someone from the next floor yells to let the fucking elevator move already, and he leans over to flick the car back into motion. Because he's Vic, and he's sometimes a little petty, he overrides the stop to skip the next floor. It makes me smile, even if it probably shouldn't. 14. Vic insists on all of us joining the family for dinner, and I both get it and am grateful for it. And with all three of his daughters home for the evening for once, the house is full of noise and laughter. No one mentions the case, or how no one can decide if I should go home or not. Holly and Brittany, the two older girls, are full of stories from college, their classes and campus life and competitions. Both are on athletic scholarships, Holly for cross country and Brittany for swimming. Janie is still in high school, but she regales us with tales from rehearsals for her summer shows, and Vic is so proud of all three of them, he can hardly see straight. As agents, we're trained to recognize the elephant in the room, to approach it somehow, but tonight, it is merrily ignored. I'm back at Edison's for the nights, though Sterling mentioned kidnapping me next week in some sort of bizarre joint custody arrangement. While I get changed into t-shirt and boxers, and it's even my female body inspector running shirt, just to make him laugh, Edison fiddles with his laptop and the cables until he's got Skype up on his massive television, Inara and Priya sprawled across the screen. "Victoria Bliss is at work," Inara offers, instead of hello. "Looks like you two are as well," I reply, accepting the bottle of beer Edison hands me and sinking down onto the couch. They both shrug, but they also look a little proud. "The literary agent I'm interning with has me reading queries and submissions," Inara says. "She makes all the decisions, of course, but she wants to know my opinion on them and then shares her process. It's interesting." Priya fans a stack of photos in such a way that we can only see corners, nothing of the subjects of the pictures. "Looking at layouts. School project or your personal project?" Edison asks. "Personal? That we still don't get to see." "You'll see it eventually," Priya grins at him, sharp and familiar, and I can actually see Edison debating whether or not he really wants to know. Inara sees it too, and buries her face in the quilt to stifle her laughter. "So, what's up? There's not a good game on, and just about anything else could be done through text or phone call. You guys okay?" "Wanted to update you guys on what's happening down here," Edison says, and both girls nod, blink, and focus on me. Our team doesn't adopt many kids the way we did these two and Victoria Bliss, but I'm always glad we've got them. Almost always glad we've got them, being the sole focus of their considerable attention and powers of observation is a little like settling into the confessional at church. Despite it being mostly my story, Edison is the one who tells them about the newest deliveries, that they happened, anyway, without sharing details, and about Siobhan. Inara nods absently, but Priya's eyes narrow when Edison gets to the breakup. Then again, Priya never actually liked Siobhan. Didn't care about her one way or the other as a human being, just didn't like that we were dating. Once, and only once, she told me why. She didn't like that I seemed only half myself with Siobhan. And, in the beauty of hindsight, she was absolutely right. But she's also the first one to ask, "Are you okay?" "For now," I tell her. "I guess I'm still waiting for it all to weigh in." "But you're going to be okay." "Yes." She starts to say something, then shakes her head. "It's okay if you're not, you know? For a while." Inara snorts along with Edison, and it's been a long time since either of them have looked horrified to agree with each other. How many times have we told Priya, and Inara for that matter, that it's okay not to be okay? "Speaking of not okay," Inara starts with a frown, "have you heard from Ravenna since she visited you? She still isn't answering her phone and hasn't responded to the email." "She hasn't called, no. Is there a specific reason you're more worried than usual?" Inara blushes, honest to God blushes, and looks down at the quilt. Somehow, despite everything, she didn't lose the ability to care for people, but she can still get embarrassed by someone pointing it out. Much like Edison, in fact. "If you were going to rank the surviving butterflies by most likely to snap and murder someone, Victoria Bliss is, no contest, number one. And I'm a close second." Edison and Priya both nod. "Ravenna is an easy third." I set my beer on the coffee table with a thunk. "Really? She said she's been doing better, at least until that last fight." "Yes and no. Separating Ravenna and Patrice the Senator's daughter, or just figuring out how they exist together, isn't going to happen around her mother or the constant publicity." "Mum offered her the guest room," Priya adds. "Paris might give her enough distance to start truly working through it, and she'd have a safe place to stay with people who care about her, and a steady link to Inara." Inara's blush, which had been fading, returns full force, as it always does when someone reminds her that she's basically the butterfly house mother, even still. "I'll let you know if she contacts me, I promise." We catch up for a bit, telling the stories that don't translate well across texts. A little after midnight, my personal phone rings. I don't recognize the number. At almost any other time, I'd let it go to voicemail. But this month has seen a rather spectacular set of circumstances, hasn't it? Edison goes very still beside me, and the girls follow suit, their faces blurred by the crappy webcam and the giant screen. On the third ring, I accept the call. "Ramirez?" "Ramirez, this is Drew Simpkins." "Shit." I thumb it over to speakerphone. "Simpkins, I've got Edison here with me. What's up?" There's no comment on Edison and I being together at midnight. Half the bureau thinks we're fucking, and the other half thinks we haven't realized yet how much we should be fucking. "Just got a call from Detective Holmes," the woman answers. "A 7-year-old boy named Mason Jeffers was dropped off outside the emergency room entrance of Prince William Hospital. He was covered in blood. None of it seems to be his. He hasn't spoken, but he's got a note safety pinned to his teddy bear that gives his name, age, and address, and says to ask for you." "And his parents?" "Holmes wants you out at the boy's house." "I'll allow it, this time." "This time," Simpkins is already on a roll. What's the address? Edison scrambles for a pen, finds a Sharpie, and writes the address out on his forearm for lack of accessible paper. We'll be there in 20, he promises, and Simpkins acknowledges before hanging up. Inara and Priya watch us gravely as we lever up from the leather couch. Be safe, Priya charges us. Let us know what you can. Do we need to cancel our trip down this weekend? Asks Inara. Don't cancel the trip, Edison says. Marlene stocked the freezers. You're not allowed to leave us with that many pastries. Well, we board the train at 6 o'clock Thursday afternoon, so if things change, that's the point of no return. Edison shakes his head, reaching for the laptop to shut it down. Only you think 6 o'clock is afternoon. You think 6 o'clock is morning, she retorts. It is morning. Not if you haven't gone to bed yet. Good night, girls. Good night, Charlie, they chorus and grin at his pained look. Just before the screen goes dark, I can see the worried looks they flash to me. I'll call Sterling while I'm changing, I tell Edison. You'll call Vic? See, not that either of them can do anything, but we'll keep them updated. Sterling takes the news calmly, telling me to keep her informed through the morning, and she'll take care of the first couple of coffee runs. Sterling is an angel. I come back out in jeans and a windbreaker, with a different t-shirt on underneath, because I just cannot make myself put on a suit after midnight. I have better clothes at the office if we don't come back, and besides, I'm desk-bound anyway. If I can't use that to bend the dress code, what's the point? The Jeffers house is all the way on the west side of town, what should be a 30-minute drive with cooperating traffic lights. The lights are not cooperating, but neither is Edison. We get there in 18 minutes. After signing in with the uniform at the door, we head inside and nearly run into Agent Simpkins. Drew Simpkins is a well-respected agent in her mid-40s, with a mane of coarse, dark blonde hair that never looks quite tame. She guest lectures at the Academy about the impact of psychology on children's writing, specifically looking at how to pick up cues and subtext in diaries or writing assignments, and leads that portion of the CAC-specific training. The BAU wanted her pretty badly for one of their profiling teams, but she's resolutely remained in Crimes Against Children. She was the one to correctly identify that I wrote the NAT's survival guide. Apparently, I have a voice. Other three cases, it's always been the father who got the worst of it, right? She also doesn't believe in small talk. Yes, I reply. Father was subdued with gunshots. Mother was killed. Father was finished off. Not the case here? Doesn't seem like it. Come, take a look. We grab booties in the hallway and slip them on over our sneakers before following her down the hall to the master bedroom. The medical examiner gives us a two-fingered wave as she keeps the thermometer steady in Mr. Jeffers's liver. He has several stab wounds across his torso, but not nearly to the extent of the other male victims. Mrs. Jeffers, however, Jesu Cristo. Her face is destroyed, and the carnage continues downward. Her groin is a solid cluster of wounds, and the other stab wounds littering her stomach stretch up into slices at and around her breasts. Her husband's death was pretty straightforward, but this woman suffered. And, judging from the negative space on her side of the bed, her son was forced to stand there and watch. You said Mason wasn't speaking? I ask. Detective Mignone standing by the father's side of the bed, looks up and nods.
Neighbor says she doesn't think he's spoken in years.
So it's not trauma-based.
Or it's not based on this trauma, Simpkins notes.
She pulls out one of the framed pictures off the wall and holds it out to me, then realizes I don't have gloves and keeps it steady so I can see it.
There's blood spattered on the glass. Not a lot at this distance, but some.
It's not enough to obscure the way the family is posed in the portrait. Mrs. Jeffers's hand wrapped around her son's arm as he tries to pull away toward his father.
Sexual abuse by the female parent? Edison murmurs over my shoulder. That's uncommon.
Why do you assume the abuse was sexual? Asks Simpkins, who clearly already knows the answer, but is asking it anyway. That would be the teacher part of her personality.
The way the wounds are clustered,
Edison answers automatically, because we are both used to Vic, after all.
Groin, breasts, mouth. That's a very specific grouping.
Social services? I ask.
We have a call in.
Their social worker on call is already at Prince William on a different case, so she was going to put a call out for backup.
Seems like Mason might do better with a male social worker.
She's going to do her best to get one in. They're understaffed at the moment.
All the public services in this county are.
The teddy bear, was it the same? Simpkins carefully replaces the frame on the wall. White, gold wings, and halo.
And the note was pinned on the bear?
Handwritten or typed? Adds Edison.
Typed, Simpkins answers.
We had a look at the computers, but the killer brought the note with them. The Jefferses don't even have a printer.
So the killer knew in advance that Mason probably couldn't be coached to say anything. She came prepared.
Why are you saying she?
Edison and I trade a look, and Mignone drifts a little closer to the conversation.
The description the children gave, Edison says finally. They all called her a lady.
But we don't actually know that it is. Saying she could blind us to avenues.
I'm not implying the children lied, or even that they were mistaken. But just because someone in a costume seems to present as female, it doesn't mean they are,
Mignone finishes.
Could be a tactic to throw suspicion the wrong way.
Precisely.
It's perfectly reasonable and actually better practice to not block off avenues of investigation, but my gut says we're looking for a woman. A man might dress as a female, given the appropriate impulses, but the phrasing would be different. This killer says the children are going to be safe now. A man would say he was rescuing them or making them safe. Men are more likely to announce actions. Women, states of being.
And judging from the way Simpkins is watching us, she's already come to the same conclusion. She's just putting us through the paces.
Exhibit A as to why I always learn a hell of a lot from Simpkins, but I don't actually like working with her.
Holmes is at the hospital with the boy, Mignone says. She wasn't in the room during the examination, but he had a panic attack when the doctor needed to check beneath his underwear. They actually had to sedate him.
Did they finish the examination? Edison asks with a frown. But Mignone shakes his head.
He didn't seem obviously injured, and they want to try to build a measure of trust with him. They did some scans to assess for internal damage, to make sure they could wait, but otherwise they want him to be awake and allowing them.
Edison's shoulders relax.
Do you mind if I go to Mason's room? I ask. I won't touch anything, I promise. For an answer, Simpkins offers us pairs of gloves.
Okay, so maybe I will touch things.
Edison trails after me, along with Mignone.
Mason's room belongs in a magazine.
Being officially on the case, the detective can be our crime scene chaperone, as it were, able to swear, if a problem comes up later, that no evidence was planted, taken, or altered. The walls are painted in halves, the top a dusky blue, the bottom a deeper royal blue, separated by a white paper border covered with colorful figures in a number of different professions. I can see cowboys represented, astronauts and doctors, different branches of the military, among others. His bed is plastic and low to the ground, shaped like a cartoon rocket, and except for the indentations where he lay and one corner folded back from when he got up, the blue sheets and comforter are perfectly made. Everything in this room is picture perfect, designed for appearance rather than function. Nothing in here actually says, "little boy." Edison opens the drawers of the dresser, his gloved hands easing between layers of perfectly folded and color-coordinated clothing. The closet is as pristine as the room, clear storage bins on the top shelf, eliminating any chance of Mason using them to hide anything. Children like the idea of secrets. They don't actually like keeping them, usually. Children want to tell people things. The action figures in the toy box look barely touched, but the stuffed animals show a troubling bit of personality. They all have pants stapled onto them. Some of the pants are heavy construction paper, some look like doll clothes, but they're stapled onto the fabric of the animals in a very worrying, very telling way. Edison grimaces when I show him, but nods.
"That can't really be all," he says.
"Maybe not." Heading back to the bed, I ease my hand behind the head of the bed and feel the glove slip over something with a different texture. "Mignone!" The detective lifts his camera and snaps photos of the bed before and after we pull it from the corner. A plastic sheet protector, like a report cover, is taped to the back, filled with sheets of extra-thick cardstock. Mignone slowly lowers his camera.
"Are those paper dolls?"
"Yes." I pull the pages out of the protector and spread them across the floor. They were probably torn out of a book at some point. A family of paper dolls, but the father and both children have pants attached front and back, not with the folded tabs, but with more staples. The doll for the mother is colored over with black marker, drawn so firmly the marker soaked through and tore the thick paper in places.
"Shit," mutters Edison,
and Mignone nods, even as he lifts the camera to snap pictures.
"I'm not top of the game for child psych, but that's a pretty distinctive sign of sexual abuse, right?"
asks the detective.
"Yes. Yes, it is."
Edison lightly kicks my ankle.
"You think there's a CPS file, don't you?"
"It fits the pattern. And these markers, the pants on the toys and paper dolls, the mother being crossed out so vehemently, are so clear. Someone had to have noticed and reported it."
"What's your theory, Ramirez?"
To give myself time to finish sorting the thought into words, I stack the paper dolls back together and slide them into the sheet protector, giving the whole thing to Mignone.
"I think there was some sort of accident somewhere. Maybe at Sunday school or a friend's birthday party. Something. Maybe a bathroom accident. Maybe just something spilling, but enough to need to change pants, and an adult offered to help. A little boy freaks out to that degree about someone helping him change pants? Questions are going to get asked,"
Edison agrees.
"Maybe it was even at school. Someone asked his parents, probably his mother," adds Mignone. "Mrs. Jeffers isn't employed."
And, of course, his mother says he's just body shy, and he'll grow out of it.
But whoever asks the questions is still bothered by it, and eventually makes a report.
But how do you get from a report that vague to murder?
Until we hear back from social services, we don't know if it was vague, I remind Mignone. They may have followed up, maybe even done an exam. If there isn't penetration or bruising, the abuse isn't going to be as obvious.
You know, I sort of assumed getting a new team member would break you and Edison of that habit, Simpkins drawls from the door. Instead, you're indoctrinating others.
Groupthink is a useful tool if it's not overused, I say mildly. Simpkins doesn't encourage that degree of interdependence among her agents. She and Vic used to argue about it sometimes, especially after she got stuck with us for a month while Vic was in the hospital.
That isn't your entire theory, she says after a minute.
I think you need to look at the social workers, I admit. When a parent is sexually abusing a child, the father is usually the safe assumption, but this person knew to go after the mother. This is someone with access to the accusations, at least, maybe even the files themselves. This is someone in the system.
Or someone attached to someone in the system.
Edison shifts uncomfortably.
That would be a pretty big indiscretion, Agent Simpkins. Someone who spills secrets like that would be fired pretty quickly.
Perhaps. Or perhaps they only spill secrets to one individual.
Even if that's the case, they're still complicit, I point out. These murders have been hitting the news. The details may not be out there, but the names are. Even if the one in the system isn't doing the killing, they have to realize that this isn't a coincidence. If they're actively part of it, if they're just trying to protect a partner, they're still helping a murderer.
We'll see, she says noncommittally. Thank you for your assistance, agents. You can leave now.
She takes the paper dolls from Mignone's hand and disappears back into the hallway.
Mignone stares after her, looking conflicted.
Is she always...
Yes, we answer in unison. Edison gives me a ghost of a grin and continues.
Whatever word you were searching for?
Yes.
The answer is always yes.
She plays things very close to the chest, I add. She doesn't like assumptions. She doesn't like what she perceives to be sloppy language, and she thinks our verbal free-for-alls are undisciplined. For all that, she's a very good agent with a solid track record.
Uh-huh.
After she meets with Holmes and forms an opinion, she'll assign one of her agents to be the main point of contact with MPD. She's got good people under her.
Mignone's salt-and-pepper mustache twitches. It's bushy enough that his exact expression is a little hard to read.
When honesty and loyalty collide, which wins?
Honesty. At the repeated unison, unintentional this time, Edison and I turn and stick our tongues out at each other, and Mignone barks a laugh.
It's a shame you two can't work this.
I get it, he continues quickly, holding up one hand. Though I'm not sure either of us was about to protest.
Just a shame.
My skin crawls with the need to be working this case, to push everything else to the side and find out who's doing this. Who is this person who cares so much in such a twisted way? That's probably exactly why I'm not allowed to. Once upon a time, there was a girl who was scared of angels. Some of Daddy's friends called her that, Pretty Angel or just Angel. Mama used to call her that, but she'd stopped even before she died. One of the men even had a little pewter pin of an angel
he always wore on his shirts, between his collar and his shoulder. She stared at it whenever Daddy took his money. He said it was his guardian angel. She tried to think of other things, like the fort back in the woods. It seemed so far away, and she dreamed of taking a blanket and a bag of clothes and running away to live there forever. The other kids in the neighborhood played there, but she'd never been welcome. Or maybe she could just walk, and walk, and walk, and walk, and end up someplace new every day, and Daddy couldn't follow. But she couldn't escape, no matter how hard she tried to think of other things. One night, while she stared at that angel pin, there was a knock on the door upstairs. You could always hear everything in that house. It had no secrets. All the men froze. There was never a knock at night. Everyone was already there. There was a voice calling something, loud but indistinct over the music. The little girl kept her eyes on the angel. But the noise continued, and before Daddy and his friends got to their feet, the basement door was kicked in with a blaze of light, forging halos behind the people who stood there. The man with the pin pulled away from her, and in the panic and babble, one of Daddy's friends lifted a gun. The little girl didn't pay much attention to the gun. That was never the thing to hurt her. Instead, she watched one of the new people approach her, her dark curls lined in light. The woman crouched over her, covering the little girl's body as much as she could, but her gun stayed in her hands and trained on Daddy's friend until he dropped his gun to the carpet and put his hands in the air. Then the woman grabbed a blanket and wrapped the little girl in it, hugging her close, but oh so gently. Her eyes were kind and sad, and she stroked the little girl's hair and whispered that she was going to be okay. She was going to be okay. She was safe now. She gave the girl a teddy bear to hug and cry into, and stayed with her even as others crowded into the basement to take away Daddy and all his friends. Daddy was furious, yelling terrible things, but the woman just hugged the girl and covered her ears so she didn't have to hear what her daddy said. The lady stayed with her in the ambulance and in the hospital and told her she was going to be okay. Once upon a time, there was a little girl who was scared of angels. Then she met one, and she wasn't afraid anymore. 15. Late the next morning, when the caffeine from the many coffee runs has stripped a hole in my gut, I take the elevator down to the cafeteria to pick up some bagels or whatever else strikes my fancy. On the way back up, another agent skips into an otherwise empty car just before the doors close. "Have you eaten lunch yet?" "Hello to you too, Cass." Cassandra Kearney is on Simpkins' team, but she's also a friend. We came up through the academy together, and now that I think on it, she's probably the biggest reason the survival guide has, well, survived. She's wearing her glasses, which means she's at least halfway to exhausted. "Lunch?" I look down at the bundle of plastic-wrapped sandwiches in my arms, then at the slightly manic glint in her eye. That glint never spells good things for me. "Let me give these to Edison and Sterling, and I'll grab my bag."
"Great. I'll wait for you here."
"In the elevator?" She glances at the opening doors, then positions herself in the corner with the control panel, where she can't be seen from the hall. Cass attempting subterfuge is invariably frightening. As bad as she is at it, though, she always has a good reason for it. So, rather than argue, I'll go along with it. Edison isn't at his desk, but Sterling is at hers, reading through a consult request I'm not allowed to touch. I pyramid the sandwiches on the corner of her desk. Tell him I'm off to lunch with a friend from the academy, okay?
He'll know who it is?
Probably. Most of my friends from those days aren't based in Quantico, so it limits the pool of possibilities. The fact that I didn't mention the name should be the real tip-off. I'll be back.
Roger that.
When Cass said she'd wait there, she really meant right there. She's got a foot stuck in the elevator track to keep the doors from closing. Anderson tries to get past her into the elevator, and she actually snarls at him. I wait just inside the bullpen until he gives up and uses the stairs, then join Cass. We don't talk on our way down or on our way to the garage.
Are we avoiding being seen together?
I mutter.
Please.
Then I'm on level 2. Pick me up on the way down. She nods, not looking at me. Her keys bounce against her thigh. She jogs off to the garage elevator, and I walk up the ramp to my car on the second level. I don't think anyone's watching, but just in case, and because it will probably make her feel better, as worked up as she is, I rummage through my trunk like I'm looking for something. When I hear her car pull up, I close the trunk, lock the car, and slide into her passenger seat.
Now are you going to explain?
We're going to make a quick stop before we eat, she says.
Where?
Manassas CPS.
Oh, shit, Cass.
I close my eyes and let my head thunk back against the headrest. You wouldn't be pulling this cloak-and-dagger fuckery if you hadn't explicitly been told not to involve me. Her pained silence is answer enough.
Cass, qué mierda.
Simpkins says we're not allowed to update your team at all. The farther we get from the bureau building, the more she relaxes into her seat. It's not like we took a case over from you. This is your life.
Cass.
They were able to finish the exam on Mason Jeffers, she says all in a rush. There were signs of intermittent penetrative abuse, but here's the kicker. He's got herpes.
Herpes?
Type 1, so basically cold sores, but he's got it on his genitals.
Let me guess. The mother has a history of cold sores.
Right. I sigh. A 7-year-old with an STI. Holmes wants you to talk to the earlier victims. Mason still won't speak at all. And the psychologist doesn't think we should push it with having women around him. But Holmes wants you to check in with the others. Simpkins says no contact.
What does Holmes think checking in will do?
Show the killer you're still on this.
So Holmes had the same thought I did, that the killer's rage might turn on me if it looks like I abandoned these kids.
Unless Holmes withdraws the request for bureau assistance, Simpkins is the agent in charge. She gets to make that call.
Cass sneezes.
Our entire academy cohort called her Kitten because she sneezes every time she laughs.
You're not really going to try to convince me you like it.
No, I fucking hate it, but it's not my call, and I don't get to go behind her back.
Actually, I was thinking of telling Holmes to go to Hanoverian.
I thump my head against the seat several times, hoping it will knock something useful loose.
You want to tell the local detective to go over your boss's head to the unit chief? So a targeted agent can talk to previous victims.
When you put it like that, it sounds bad.
I wonder why.
She sneezes again.
If you're trying to sneak me to the kids, why are you kidnapping me to CPS instead of the hospital?
Because I need to stop at CPS. I was on my way and figured the car ride was the best chance to talk to you.
She chances a glance over at me. As she merges onto the highway.
You know how Drew is about your team. She doesn't think it's healthy for a team to stay the same for so long. She's even talking of trading out the Smiths, and they've been...